As a teenager, when I went to events with my theologically conservative youth groups, there were often t-shirts and bumper stickers and other such items for sale with anti-science slogans. They didn't call it that explicitly, but they said things like, you know, "Sure, I believe in the Big Bang. God spoke, and bang, it was." There was this orientation to protecting the past, that all these paradigm-shifting religious events had happened a long time ago, and that our role was to defend belief in these miraculous events against new ways of understanding the world that saw these ancient stories as myths and legends. In contrast, Unitarian Universalism is called a living tradition. We have a bias toward progress in the present and evolution into the future. Indeed, the title of our gray hymnal is Singing the Living Tradition. And as one of the classic hymns in that book says, we revere the past, but trust the dawning future more. More broadly, we are part of the progressive movement in religion that is sometimes called, that comes out of what is called the liberal turn in religion back in the 1700s as part of the Enlightenment. And that liberal turn in religion is not the turn to the Democratic Party, right? It's the Latin root liber, meaning free. So it's a movement toward freedom in religion. It's this move from authority grounded in community, that we believe it because that's what everyone else believes, or we believe it because of hierarchy. You believe it because the priest or the bishop tells you to believe it, or you believe it because of tradition, right? Because that's allegedly what we've always believed. So it's a shift from there to authority grounded in reason, what is logical, to authority grounded in experience, what you know to be true because you've experienced it firsthand for yourself, or because it can be proven objectively through the scientific method. That's why you see more people that are on the other side of the liberal turn in religion saying, you know, well, the Bible may say women should be silent in church, but I've seen some great women ministers, I'm going with that. Seems good experience, right? So that's it. I mean, do you see the difference between experience, you know, authority grounded in reason and experience versus authority, tradition, community? So historically, we UUs have been on the front lines of embracing modern science and adjusting our theology accordingly. So it makes sense that our fifth source is humanist teachings, which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science and warn us against idolatries of the mind and spirit. For UUs, science is neither an enemy nor even merely an ally. Science is fully inside the big tent of Unitarian Universalism. It used to be that arguments were made from Scripture alone, without reference to science. Genesis 1 says that God is the creator of heavens and the earth, so that's what happened, as the bumper sticker says. God said it, I believe it, that settles it. But now we see absurdities like the Creation Museum in Kentucky that tries to prove on science's terms. So no longer are they just saying, you know, the scripture says it, I believe it, that settles it. They're trying to prove on science's terms that the Bible is literal historical truth. So that leads to exhibits like Adam and Eve riding on the back of dinosaurs at the Creation Museum. But they're dead serious. What many religious fundamentalists don't seem to realize is that what they've conceded is allowing science to redefine the battlefield, such that both sides are now trying to prove their point not through biblical interpretation, but with the scientific method. And they're ultimately going to lose, because science is going to win when science rightly determines the battlefield. This shift happened because, frankly, modern science is so impressive. It's hard to deny the power of the scientific method when it has given us, you know, the smartphone, the internet, space travel, and so much more. But the effectiveness of science was not obvious from the beginning. And I'd like us to reflect some briefly this morning on how we have come to have our fifth source of reason and the results of science. For those of you interested in going deeper, this sermon was inspired by a book titled To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science by the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg. So as we turn to the history of how we as a species came increasingly to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science, it may be helpful to keep in mind the quip from L.P. Hartley's novel. So as we look back at these ancient figures, keep in mind that the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. So if, for example, we consider the pre-Socratic philosophers, they're honestly fascinating to read, but in many cases they use what we would call logical fallacies or even sophistry, clever but unsound reasoning. You see them repeatedly making claims with absolutely no justification. Thales argues that obviously the universal primary substance is water. That's not a bad idea, right? Water becomes ice, water becomes steam. It's not a terrible idea, but Anaximander used similar arguments to say, no, the universal primary substance is air. Xenophanes makes the case that it's actually earth. You start to get them to make a name for themselves, they had to come up with a new idea, right? It's like a dissertation topic. Heraclitus said it was fire. Empedocles said that, oh, actually everything is made of a combination of earth, wind, fire, and air. All of these arguments are interesting from a certain point of view, but none of them are what we would call evidence-based by what we mean through the scientific method. And you see the same thing happening in theology. To give just one example from the second century, the early church father Irenaeus wrote a book called Against Heresy. So he was trying to refute all of the people that were not orthodox in his opinion. And so he said, you know, the reason that the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John should be read and not the Gospels of Thomas or Mary or many of the other Gospels being written at the time, he said that, well, the Gospels could not possibly be either more or less in number than they are, since there are four zones of the world in which we live, four principal winds, you know, east, west, south, and north. The pillar of the foundation of the church is the gospel, and it fittingly has four pillars. That is classic sophistry. It is somewhat persuasive rhetoric if you're just kind of in the moment, but it makes absolutely no sense if you take one half step back from the propaganda. Because one could, of course, think of similar analogies to justify any number of gospels. The larger point is that you can't build anything on such false premises. You can't start from the fanciful foundation that everything is made from some combination of earth, wind, fire, and air, and eventually discover how to make an iPhone. But the scientific method can and has given us inventions that have transformed our world, both in positive and negative ways. And one of the bridges to understanding the power of the scientific method, of setting up experiments to test a hypothesis against reality, one of the bridges to that was music with the ancient Pythagoreans in ancient Greece. They noticed that if you take, as I taught about during the story, that if you take two strings of equal thickness and composition and tension and pluck them at the same time, the sound is pleasant if the lengths of the strings are a ratio of small numbers, as I'm sure all of you remember. So, you know, and that you take, they started to notice, like, an octave, it's exactly one half the length, and that a fifth was two thirds the length, and that a fourth, if you had three fourths the length. By contrast, if the length of the two strings aren't a ratio of small numbers, it sounds jarring, and you didn't get until, like, Schoenberg in the 20th century that started to say dissonance is a good thing, right? Arguably so, but these observations and experiments helped link music and math, as well as the beginning of the ability to use reasoning to make predictions about reality. And it led the Pythagoreans to become, you know, sort of obsessed, really in a spiritual sense, with the music of the spheres and with math, leading to things like the Pythagorean theorem, which may still haunt some of you, right? A squared plus B squared equals C squared, area of a triangle and such. Ultimately, though, it's also important to point out that pure mathematics is not a natural science, right? There is applied math, but pure mathematics is not a natural science. It is not a branch of science that deals with the physical world. Rather, math is a language. It is a tool that can be used in science. However, mathematics in itself, without observation, cannot tell us anything about the world. And conversely, any mathematical theorem can neither be verified nor refuted by observation of the world, totally pure math. But it's precisely on the close observations of the natural world that science began to progress. We see thinkers among our ancestors slowly letting go of unfounded speculation and beginning to make small discoveries that are increasingly sophisticated methods of observation and measurement and experimentation and the ensuing formulation and testing and modification of hypotheses based on those experiments. And it really was when they started letting go of these wild speculations about life, the universe, and everything, and started just focusing on small things and making the experiments, and then that slowly built on itself. So 5,000 years ago, the ancient Egyptians were using stars. And back then, they didn't have all this electric light, so they could see the 27, you know, you shouldn't be seeing 20 stars in the night sky. We see a few more in Frederick than you see in D.C. You should be seeing 27,000 stars in the night sky. So that's what they did at night instead of watching Netflix. So they were able to, 5,000 years ago, use the stars to track and predict when the Nile would flood, which was crucial for their agriculture. And it's, of course, a myth that everyone thought the world, many people may have thought the world was flat before Columbus, but plenty of people didn't, especially educated ones. There were ancient Greeks around 2,500 years ago who made an educated guess for why Earth is a sphere, based on observing that the Earth's shadow on the moon during a lunar eclipse is curved, and that the position of stars in the sky seemed to change as we travel south to north. Now, they were wrong because they thought that, you know, that the Earth was in the center and the sun was revolving around us, but still, they made some pretty... And that's also part of the history of science, is still making progress even when you're wrong about... You're not fully right, but you're correct about some things. And the debate over whether to support the proposed expedition of Columbus concerned, actually, not the shape of the Earth, but its size. Columbus thought the Earth was small enough that he could sail from Spain to the east coast of Asia without running out of food and water. So he was wrong about the size of the Earth, but he was saved by the unexpected appearance of the Americas between Europe and Asia, to the chagrin of the indigenous people. Even with all the important discoveries in the ancient world, the real paradigm shift, the real point at which, you know, modern science and ancient science start to look, you know, starts to make sense, as we would call science, that really happened with the scientific revolution in the 16th century, with Copernicus's discovery that the Earth is not the center of the universe, that we are just the third rock from the sun. And Copernicus's book on the revolution of the heavenly spheres, that was published in 1543, only 26 years after Martin Luther nailed his 95 Theses to the door of Wittenberg Chapel in Germany, catalyzing the Protestant Reformation. But even as these Protestant reformers were seeking a radical revolution in religion, many of them, if not most of them, remained resistant to science. Regarding Copernicus, Luther wrote, "This is what that fool does who wishes to turn the whole of astronomy upside down." Luther said, "I believe in the Holy Scriptures, for Joshua commanded the sun to stand still and not the earth." So here we see that aforementioned argument from Scripture being used against the argument from scientific evidence. But long before the New Atheist movement, scientists were getting in their barbs as well. Johannes Kepler wrote about religious resistors to Copernicus in one of his books in a paragraph with the indelicate title, "Advice for Idiots." He wrote, "Whoever is too stupid to understand astronomical science or too weak to believe Copernicus without it affecting his faith, I would advise him that having dismissed astronomical studies and having damned whatever philosophical studies he pleases, he mind his own business and betake himself home to scratch his own dirt patch." Unfortunately, calling your opponent an idiot is rarely a way to win friends and influence people. That being said, it's important to recognize that it is that same irrational fear of science that put Copernicus's books on the religious banned book list, that is parallel to the sophistry that fuels climate change denial today. It is clever but unsound reasoning. Keep in mind the words of our fifth principle. Humanist teachings, which counsel us to, you know, and humanist meaning the human, right? Being the best we humans can figure out from our human, limited, finite point of view. Humanist teachings, which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science and warn us against idolatries of the mind and spirit. Climate change denial, as with the denial of evolution, is an idolatry. It is revering a falsehood. But here's the challenge of the scientific revolution. Accept the world as it actually is and act accordingly. As the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick liked to say, reality is what doesn't go away when you stop believing in it. And science is about coming to terms with reality as it actually is. But there's been a long process of coming to trust science, and that continues into our own time. When antiseptic techniques were discovered for cleaning your hands in a way that drastically reduces the likelihood of infection, most physicians still initially refused to adopt antiseptic practices when moving from patient to patient. Similarly, practices like bleeding patients were widely used, even though they had never been proven to be effective, and eventually were proven to be incredibly harmful for patients. You're just weakening them. Tragically, medical history is riddled with unfounded theories like humorism, that we have four humors inside us, you know, blood, phlegm, black bile, and yellow bile, which respectively were thought to make us sanguine, phlegmatic, melancholic, or choleric, depending on the balance of the humors within us. But we know now that humorism was just wild speculation, akin to this pre-Socratic idea that everything in the universe was made of some combination of earth, wind, air, and fire. Ironically, the opportunity for physicians, well up until modern times, to study theories. So they went to university to study, you know, humorism and not astronomy, but astrology. So that's what you learned in medical school, that gave much higher prestige to physicians who had done that compared to surgeons who knew how to do really useful things like setting bones, but until modern times were not trained in university. Similarly, clinical trials were not required for new medicines until well into the 20th century, so much of what's passed as that was just snake oil. Indeed, students of the history of medicine have often remarked that until sometime around the beginning of the 20th century, the average sick person would have been better avoiding the care of physicians. Thankfully, we live a century into the age of scientific, evidence-based medicine. So as I move toward my conclusion about this history of why we UUs treasure our fifth source of science, I invite you to hear these words from Steven Weinberg's book, To Explain the World. He writes that, faced with a puzzling world, people in every culture have sought explanation. Thales tried to understand matter by guessing that it was all water. But what could he do with this idea? But imagine how Ptolemy must have felt when he realized that he had found a theory of planetary motion that allowed him to predict with fair accuracy where any planet could be found in the sky at any moment. What pleasure Copernicus must have felt when he was able to explain that the fine-tuning and the looping orbits of Ptolemy's scheme arose simply because we view the solar system from a moving Earth. Still flawed, the Copernican theory did not quite fit the data without ugly complications. So how much, then, the mathematically gifted Kepler must have enjoyed replacing the Copernican mess with motions of the planetary ellipses instead of circular motion. So despite the excitement and the power of scientific discoveries, the attitude of religion toward science has often been along the lines of, what does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? right? That they should just be kept apart. In contrast, Unitarian Universalism invites us to choose both. The best wisdom of the world's religions balanced with the best insights of modern science, of taking into account all that we know here in the early 21st century. And from our 21st century pluralistic, postmodern, globalized perspective, we know that despite the power of science, there are also limitations to what the scientific method can address. As religious traditions testify, some experiences are subjective, uncanny, and rare, and do not lend themselves to easy, repeatable study in laboratory conditions. Or as the scientist J.S. Haldane said about the implications of quantum mechanics, the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, it is queerer than we can suppose. In that spirit, I'll leave you with this advice from the philosopher Wittgenstein, who said, "Don't think, look." Don't think, look. Don't limit yourself by always thinking in advance how you presume the world is or how you have been taught the world must be. Look, observe closely inside yourself. Look at others, look at this world around you closely. Test, experiment, what works, what doesn't. How might you, how might we? How might future generations learn to better explain the world? When I think about the great sweep of scientific history, and especially in relation to how we might do theology in the 21st century, the best shorthand that I've found for that is four names: Copernicus, Darwin, Einstein, Hubble. That as Michael Dowd, the evolutionary evangelist, you know, when he was here probably well over a year ago or more now, he talked about the difference between what he called flat earth faith and evolutionary faith, right? And that he said the problem with flat earth faith, and we talked about that, you know, footnote what I said earlier, he said the problem with it is that it's BC, and that it's not before Christ, it's before Copernicus, right? And that we can still learn from all of that. We don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but, you know, if we fail to take into account what we know, you know, now AC, after Copernicus, then we're doing it wrong. And so that with Copernicus, we had just a tremendous decentering, right? That we used to think that Earth, that we were the center of life, that we were the point, right? Why everything's here was the Earth, that we were the center of life, the universe, and everything. And after Copernicus, we found out actually the sun's the center of the universe and not, you know, the Earth is just the third rock from the sun. So that was a tremendous decentering of our planet. With Darwin, and that was the great intellectual struggle of the 16th century, the 1500s. And then Darwin with evolution, showing us that we're not a little lower than the angels, but just a little higher than the apes, and deeply interconnected with the ecosystems of this planet, this one precious, perilous planet, this blue marble floating through the inky depths of space. Coming to terms with that was the great intellectual struggle of the 19th century, one that some are still choosing to wage in the 21st century. But that was a tremendous decentering. As Copernicus had been a decentering of our planet, Darwin was a decentering of our species, that we weren't at the center of everything. Einstein decentered space and time, showing us that they are relative. And, you know, that's when things really started to get spooky and uncanny and quantum entanglement and things like that. And then with Hubble, we got this decentering of our solar system, right? Edwin Hubble, like, who the telescope is named afterwards, that we started to see. The latest count I've heard is upward of 400 billion, not million, 400 billion other galaxies. And, you know, so we're in a solar system, right? We're on the corner of the Milky Way galaxy is spiral, right? So we're on the corner of one galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, that is one among more than 400 billion other, not solar systems, but galaxies in the universe. That's an even more tremendous decentering. So the decentering of our planet, of our species, and then of our galaxy, not even just our solar system. So that, you know, so, and then coming to terms with that was the great struggle of the 20th, and now we're already in the 21st. 21st century. So that, but that's part of what Unitarian Universalism invites us to do, is, you know, with many sources, with the best of what we know, to figure out how should we live, how should we support one another and this planet. So as you go into the coming days and weeks, continue your journey with love. Care for one another and care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And as you go, whatever taste or touch you've had in this time and place of hope, of love, or peace, or joy, that goes with you out into the world. We're different for having spent this time together. So live boldly and with thanksgiving. Go in peace.